Well, thank you, praise team, for that music set. I thought it was very appropriate and well done, and something very healing about singing to the Lord in the midst of these times. And I trust that the Lord will use this message, I think, to kind of build upon what God has ordained as a theme in our church of helping the weak, those who have been stricken by the fall and are uniquely bearing the consequences of the curse. So let me pray, and then we'll get started. Father, we come before you as the great, awesome, comforting God. You're the God of all comfort, the Father of all mercies, and I pray that we will be your agents of mercy, and that you will help this message to accomplish that aim. Pray that I might be clear. Pray that this word will resound in the hearts and souls of many. In Christ's name, amen. Well, in William Shakespeare's Henry V, the armies of England face a grim prospect. They are taking on the French, and they are outnumbered 5-1, and the French are fresh for battle. The young king tours the camp at night in disguise, and he finds out that the whole army is rapidly losing morale. They do not believe that they can win. But then the young King Henry V stirs their souls by reminding them that today is St. Crispin's Day. And whenever this day shall pass in the future, those who participate in this battle will have an added hop in their step, as they'll know that this was a day of the greatest victory in England. They will show their scars. They will tell stories. Their names will be mentioned in song as they remember this day. And all of England will be envious of them that they were not part of the chosen few to be a part of the battle of St. Crispin's Day. And then he says this, "We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he never so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. If you are with me in battle, you are my brother from this day forward. Doesn't matter how petty our arguments once were. Doesn't matter if I like your demeanor. Doesn't matter if we naturally connect as friends. If you are in battle with me, I consider you a band of brothers." And thus the term was born. Now, when we look at battle and warfare, something miraculously often happens with total strangers, where the bonds of friendship and brotherhood are forged. And often this is God's mean of really sustaining us in the midst of adversity. In fact, we read in Proverbs 17:17, "A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity." There are moments when you go from friendship to brotherhood, where you stick by the other person, you save and sustain their soul. We read in Ecclesiastes 4:12, "And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken." Friendships are a means of sustaining and saving lives. Now, in 1 Samuel chapter 20, we are going to witness the most famous friendship in world history, a heroic friendship between David and Jonathan. In 1 Samuel chapter 20, we will see that it is this friendship which God uses to save the future anointed king of Israel. In 1 Samuel chapter 20, we see how a man after God's own heart is enriched and benefits from a friendship as Jonathan bears him up in the midst of adversity. And frankly, all of us, we will incur some soul-shaking trial in our life. We just wait, it will come. And it is during this time that it will be friendship which will rescue you from despair and doubt. Friendship is God's means of protecting the faithful. God sends faithful friends. God forges faithful friendships to rescue us in our hour of need. So in this message, what I plan on doing today to give you my battle plan is we're going to survey chapter 20. We're going to just see how it is that the friendship of David and Jonathan rescued David. And then we're going to reflect a little bit about five characteristics, five essential elements of a faithful friendship, one which will rescue you in adversity. And I'm going to build on this. We see five traits: loyalty, integrity, reciprocity, transparency, and transcendency. All of these things will really reveal that friendship is not something that is manufactured. It's really a reflection of who you are. As you really take on these characteristics in your own life, you prepare the way for a faithful friendship. So turn with me to 1 Samuel chapter 20. And to kind of bring you up to speed, David is the anointed king of Israel, and he proves himself on the battlefield by slaying the Philistine giant who had the audacity to taunt the armies of Israel. For the reputation of God and for the glory of the kingdom, he defeats this giant. And as a result, all Israel celebrates his praise. And Saul, who knows that the kingdom is going to be ripped away from him, begins to grow in jealousy. He seeks to take the life of this young anointed king. And yet, Jonathan sees a brother, a man who is committed to the same cause that he's committed to. Now, in chapter 19, Jonathan, as far as he is concerned, believed that he brokered peace between his father and his friend. Saul made a vow that he will not take the life of David. And perhaps that is all that Jonathan knew. Saul, as you know, did try to take his life. And at this point, he is in Ramah prophesying and allowing David a chance to escape. And David seeks out his friend for help. In verse 1, after fleeing to Jonathan, he asks him three questions. What have I done? What is my guilt? And what is my sin before your father that he seeks my life? And Jonathan responds by saying, what are you talking about? Far from it. You shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing either great or small without disclosing it to me. And why should my father hide this from me? It is not so. David, you're overreacting here. Remember, he made the vow. If he was going to try to kill you, I would surely know about it. But David pushes back a little bit and explains how is it that Jonathan would not know. He says, your father knows well that I have found favor in your eyes. And he thinks, do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly as the Lord lives, as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death. Jonathan, the reason why you don't know is your father is keeping secrets because of our relationship. I am this close to death. And so, Jonathan makes a solemn oath to reassure his friend. He says, the Lord, the God of Israel, be witness. When I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow or the third day, behold, if he is well disposed toward David, shall I not send and disclose it to you? I will investigate David. I will find out if he still has murderous intention. And if the worst is true, I will warn you and let you know. But then he goes on to say in verse 12, but should it please my father to do you harm, and the Lord do so to Jonathan, and more also, if I do not disclose it to you, and send you away that you may go in safety. May the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. If I am alive, show me the steadfast love of the Lord that I may not die. And do not cut off your steadfast love from my house forever, when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. And Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord take vengeance on David's enemies. So he says that the worst should happen, knowing that you will be the one who will one day rise to the throne, that all of your enemies will be put away. As I do you this favor, David, as I take this risk to save your life, which I will covenant before the Lord out of my love for you, what I ask you to do is, when that day comes, don't do what all the other kings do. Don't purge all rivals to your throne. Let my sons live, and let me live so that I can stand by you. And Jonathan made David swear again by his love for him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. And David reciprocates. Two friends make vows to each other. They covenant to protect each other. In verse 18, then Jonathan said to him, "Tomorrow is the new moon, and you will be missed because your seat will be empty. On the third day, go down quickly to the place where you hid yourself when the matter was in hand and remain beside the stone heap." And so Jonathan institutes a one if by land, two if by sea policy here. "And I will shoot three arrows to the side of it as though I shot at a mark. And behold, I will send the boy saying, 'Go find the arrows.' If I say to the boy, 'Look, the arrows are on the side of you, take them,' then you are to come. For as the Lord lives, it is safe for you and there is no danger. But if I say to the youth, 'Look, the arrows are beyond you,' then go, for the Lord has sent you away. And as for the matter which you and I have spoken, behold, the Lord is between you and me forever." Notice how the Lord is so central to this relationship. So with a plan in place, Jonathan begins his mission to save the life of his friend. You see phase one, the collection of intelligence in verse 24. "So David hid himself in the field, and when the new moon came, the king sat down to eat food. The Feast of the New Moon was a monthly celebration where the head of the clan would host a banquet. And in this case, it was the king who hosted his banquet and expected his son-in-law to be present. The king sat on his seat, as at other times, on the seat by the wall. And Jonathan sat opposite, and Abner sat by Saul's side, but David's place was empty. Yet Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought, 'Something has happened to him. He is not clean. Surely he's not clean.' But David is a religious man. He would take careful consideration about how to observe the law to a T. But there's something, there's a spider sense within Saul where he suspects that there's something more at hand. Verse 27, "But on the second day, the day after the new moon, David's place was empty. And Saul said to Jonathan, his son, 'Why has not the son of Jesse come to the meal, either yesterday or today?' And Jonathan answered Saul, 'David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. He said, "Let me go, for our clan holds a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. So now, if I have found favor in your eyes, let me get away and see my brothers. For this reason, he has not come to the king's table." I mean, this seems reasonable, right? It's a family celebration. He wants to be with his family this new moon feast. But Saul knows what's going on. Saul knows that David knows that he tried to kill him. He knows that David has not come back. He's not entrusting his life. And he sees that his son is covering for his friend. Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, verse 28. And he said to him, "You son of a perverse, rebellious woman." That is the nice translation, by the way. I briefly entertained giving you some alternate translations, but let's just say that wouldn't be appropriate with children present. This is a deep, vile insult on Jonathan and his mother. "Do you not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness?" Now, in that culture, the greatest privilege a woman could have is having a great son. In a patriarchal relationship where the husband basically lorded over the wife, the most special man-woman relationship would be the mother and the son. And what would bring more glory to any woman than to see her son sit on the throne of Israel? You see how Saul is trying to twist his son's will. You are breaking your mother's heart. How could you do this to her? So there's guilt. Turn in him now, Jonathan. Let us know where he is. Otherwise, you will shame your mother. And if guilt is not enough of a motivation, you see another one. Verse 31. For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. Greed. All that I have, Jonathan, could be yours. But there's just one little problem. There's a usurper to the throne. There's someone who's going to take this away from me, and if it's away from me, it'll be taken from you. So this is what you do. Therefore, send and bring him to me, for he will surely die. We'll end it right now, Jonathan. Bring me your friend. You see the temptation, right? I can restore my relationship with my parents. I can bring honor to my mother. I can rule over this great kingdom. But Jonathan answered his father, "Why should he be put to death? What has he done? He will not only not betray a friend, he will not betray an innocent man. Father, if he is guilty, you tell me what crime has he committed?" And what was the answer? But Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him. There is no answer to that. So Jonathan knew that his father was determined to put David to death. And Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for who? For himself, for David, because his father had disgraced him. His honor was tied up with David's honor. He was a true friend. And now he must distribute the intelligence. He must warn his friend. Verse 35, in the morning, Jonathan went out into the field to the appointment with David and with him a little boy. This is like getting a biopsy. And 2 weeks later, on the caller ID is the doctor's office. You didn't get the letter. You got the phone call. And when you pick up that phone, you know that what you are about to hear has the potential to change your life forever. David is in the field. He is hiding behind a heap of stones. He hears a footstep and he hears a familiar voice of Jonathan. And he knows that what will happen now will determine whether or not he can return to his wife and return to his friend and return to his house, return to his position, or whether or not he will be forced to live as an outlaw in Israel. And he said to the boy, verse 36, "Run and find the arrows that I shoot." As the boy ran, he shot the arrow beyond him. And when the boy came to the place of the arrow that Jonathan had shot, Jonathan called after the boy and said, "Is not the arrow beyond you?" And there it is. "I'm sorry, David. You were right. My father wants to kill you. You have a powerful enemy in Israel. The Philistines hate you, and now my father hates you." And Jonathan called after the boy, "Hurry, be quick. Do not stay." This cloak and dagger routine has gone on long enough. So Jonathan's boy gathered up the arrows and came to the master, but the boy knew nothing. Only Jonathan and David knew the matter, and Jonathan gave his weapons to the boy and said, "Go, carry them to the city. He is unarmed," welcoming his friend. And as soon as the boy had gone, David rose from beside the stone heap and fell on his face to the ground and bowed 3 times. And they kissed one another and wept with one another, David weeping the most. They were so distraught by the pain of the separation that they forgot their little spy regime. And so they respond. David gives him subordination. Jonathan will have none of it. You stand up and you give me a kiss or a man hug. And through the tears, Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, because we have sworn, both of us, in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord shall be between me and you, and between my offspring and your offspring forever.'" And he rose and departed from Jonathan departed, and Jonathan went into the city. They reaffirmed their love. They reaffirmed their commitment. Even though time and space will separate us, we still have a solemn commitment to each other. The Lord is between us. And so we have the Lord's anointed, the future king of Israel, whose life is preserved and saved because of his friend. A friend born for adversity. And as we look at David, and as we understand that he is a man after God's own heart, as we see that Jonathan was also his equal in character, we see that the friendship was not necessarily about what they did so much as who they were. See, a lot of times when you look at friendship, like attracts like. There's a spark that fires in a friendship where you think the same way I do. You see the same things I do. You have this connection where it seems like your souls are knit together because you value the same thing. And being a friend is not about finding a procedure. To find a faithful friend who'll stick closer to you than a brother is about being the kind of friend you always wanted to be. To have the friend you always wanted to have, you need to be the friend you always wanted to be. That you would always want them to be. I said that wrong, sorry. And I want to introduce you five characteristics. Now, this is not exhaustive. There's some elements here that you don't find. For instance, faithful are the wounds of a friend. We don't necessarily see confrontation taking place in this. But what we do see are five essential elements of a faithful friendship. The first one, and probably the most important, is loyalty. Loyalty. This speaks of being very faithful to one's commitment. And what's interesting is David and Jonathan were faithful to their commitment even though they had every reason not to be, right? You would not think that the crown prince of Israel would be faithful to his commitment to protect the life of the person who would take his throne away from him. And we would not think that the future king of Israel would make a promise to not purge any rivals to the throne out of friendship. Both of them were bound to lose something in this relationship. And yet we see in verses 14 through 15, Jonathan says, "If I am still alive, show me the," and this is the key word here, "steadfast love of the Lord, that I may not die. And do not cut off your steadfast love from the house forever, from my house forever. When the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." The word steadfast love is a Hebrew word, hesed. It speaks of a loyal covenantal love. It's a love where people stick together through thick and thin. It is a love that's willing to endure pain for the sake of keeping your promise. It is a love that is willing to endure for the sake of keeping your promise. It is the love which you can never drive away, because they will stick close to you. In Proverbs 18:24, we see that a man of many companions may come to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer to a brother. That the quality of the friendship, the willingness to stick it out, to be loyal, is a reflection of true friendship. Now, I know I've been going to Lord of the Rings often, and I plan to do so again. Because one of the great things about Lord of the Rings is the friendships that the hobbits enjoy with one another. As you know, Frodo discovered that he has a ring of power, that his life is in danger, and he needs to flee from the Shire. But he is tracked down by his three hobbit friends. Frodo resists, says, "I don't want you to come with me." But Merry has the final say, and this is what he says. "You can trust us to stick to you through thick and thin, to the bitter end. And you can trust us to keep any secret of yours closer than you yourself keep it. But you cannot trust us to let you face trouble alone and go off without a word. We are your friends, Frodo. Anyway, there it is. We know most of what Gandalf has told you. We know a good deal about the ring. We are horribly afraid. But we are coming with you or following you like hounds." Friendship requires loyalty. Loyalty is the cornerstone of friendship. Without loyalty, you can never be friends. Incidentally, this is why betrayal of that loyalty will kill a friendship. Loyalty, being faithful. And along with loyalty, its close cousin, is integrity. Integrity means you can trust somebody to be loyal. Jonathan made several promises to David. He said, "I will let you know my father's will, and I will convey the information accurately so that you can know how to rightly respond." In a sense, David was at Jonathan's mercy, was he not? Should Jonathan fudge the information, David's life would be over. But because of Jonathan's integrity, David could trust his faithful friend. In Proverbs 19:22, we read, "What is desired in a man is steadfast love, and a poor man is better than a liar." Proverbs 19:22, "What is desired in a man is steadfast love, and a poor man is better than a liar." Now, have you ever wanted to have a rich friend? A billionaire who says, "You know what, I'm going to Tahiti and I need some company. Why don't you just bring your whole family and I'll put you up in one of those bungalows over the water with the glass floors?" If you say so, "Let's go get some steak tonight." "Oh, like at Bruff's?" "Oh, no, no, no. There's this place on the plaza. I'll treat you." See, we always have this idea that having a rich friend would be wonderful. But notice the comparison here. Given the choice between a rich friend who is a liar and, let's say, a poor man who has steadfast love, what would you choose? You see, you can never be truly friends with someone who is a liar. When they lack integrity, you have no assurance that they will stick to you through thick and thin. You always wonder if they will sell you down the river. David was able to trust Jonathan, and Jonathan was able to trust David because they were both men of integrity. Further, they were able to make good on the promises that they gave each other. You see, another element is their reciprocity. Galatians 6:2, "Bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ." There is something that is given to both of them. You notice how Jonathan made a covenant with David, and David made a covenant with Jonathan. David made a covenant to protect Jonathan's offspring in the future. Jonathan made a covenant to protect David in the here and now. They both offered something and they gave something to each other. This was a true friendship. And this is different from, let's say, the rich friend friendship, right? Where one person gets something from the other. The information, the wisdom, and everything just flows one way, where one's a receiver and one is the giver. Now, those are important relationships to have. Often they're found in mentor-discipleship relationships. But to have the true brotherhood, there has to be some reciprocity. And to have that reciprocity, you have to see your friendship as not as a means of taking so much as giving. And when both people see their friendship as a means of giving, a friendship is born. But to give implies an element of trust, doesn't it? Where there's a willingness to give of yourselves, to make yourself vulnerable for the sake and edification of the other person. And this requires transparency. See, one of the enemies of friendship is a lack of trust. If David was suspicious of Jonathan, if he did not trust Jonathan because he trusted no one, then Jonathan would not be able to rescue him. David trusted Jonathan by hiding where Jonathan told him to hide, did he not? He trusted Jonathan to accurately convey the information, and Jonathan trusted David to make good on his promise not to take out his sons. There is transparency that is involved. We read in Proverbs 19:17, "He who covers an offense seeks love, but he who repeats the matter separates close friends." Now, it's very rare in this day and age where we really put our lives in our friends' hands. Could happen. More than likely, it won't. But what we can do and what we often do is we put our reputation in the hands of our friends. Our friends know all of our dirt. They know all of our secrets. Brett Laird and I, we kind of have a secret pact where we were young, single, and foolish together in seminary. We had a lot of conversations, and should we ever choose to sink one another, we could pretty quickly, right? But I'd never do that to my friend. Now, covering for your friend's failings and weaknesses doesn't mean that you don't address them. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. When you see sin in your friend, you bring it up, you address it because you love them. And then when you find out any incriminating information or anything that is slightly embarrassing, any grenade that can go off and explode and just hinder their reputation or hurt them in any way, you will be the friend who will throw your body on that because you want to protect their reputation. If you want to have friends, you need to be someone who can keep confidences as well so that they can be transparent. But there's another element to this transparency. It's the freedom to show affection. Jonathan and David wept over each other, and they kissed each other. And what do most people think when they read about two men weeping over each other and kissing each other? Well, what's going on here? You see, for centuries, men and women enjoyed very strong same-sex relationships. There's pictures of men in the 19th century draped over each other. They had no shame in showing physical affection. You see, in a patriarchal culture, it was the men had their realm, the women had their realm. They came together to raise their children, but true friendship and companionship was often found in the same gender, and they were unashamed of showing affection and basically giving of themselves, both emotionally and even physically, to their friend in appropriate ways. And yet, in the late 19th century, as there became It became more in fashion to examine, let's say, homosexuality and homoeroticism, people began to pull back and reconsider things. Like you look at Abraham Lincoln and his best friend Joshua Speed. They were such good friends that they actually shared the same bed together. And that is, incidentally, where the Log Cabin Republicans, the gay lobbying group within the Republican Party, got their name. Because they're reading back modern theory upon older friendships. But Jonathan and David were friends in every way, and it was completely appropriate. Now, this is why I bring all this up. Many times, we are afraid of becoming close friends with somebody because we might be afraid of what that friend might think, or we might be afraid of what other people might think about the friendship. If I get too close to those people, other people might think we're gay. And this is a case where the sexual revolution and the sexualization of everything has ruined not only marriage and dating, but it's ruined same-sex friendships. It is possible to have a close friendship that is honoring to the Lord and completely appropriate, and we can't allow this culture, which sexualizes everything, to rob us of that privilege. Don't be afraid to be transparent. Fifthly, you need transcendency. David and Jonathan were drawn together because they were drawn to God. They both wanted to honor the reputation and glory of the Lord. He was the centerpiece of their relationship. And so when Saul tempts his son, saying, "Don't disgrace your mother, and this kingdom could be yours," when there's a temptation of guilt and greed, Jonathan is just saying, I'll have none of it. If the Lord doesn't want it, I don't want it. It is not me to decide who will sit on my father's throne. That is for the Lord. And if the Lord has a different plan, I am fine with it. They had a transcendent appreciation of the Lord. It was the Lord who was the Lord of their relationship. And incidentally, having this transcendent purpose where you're focused on the Lord and His glory really helps to deal with some of the pitfalls of relationships, one being jealousy. You mean, so often friends might become jealous of each other because one has better skills or might be better looking. In the church, you might be jealous because this friend seems to have an ascendant ministry and seems to be well-known and well-appreciated, and they all pay attention to her and not to me. But if you're both zealous for the same thing, if God's getting the glory, if she is the one who is being exalted and elevated, then far be it from you to take away from that. You are rooting for them to succeed. Jonathan was rooting for David to succeed. He was not jealous at all because they both wanted the Lord to win. It wasn't a competition. Secondly, another pitfall to friendship is selfishness. And I want to qualify this. Listen to this carefully. It's not selfishness in that David and Jonathan weren't willing to share with each other. It's that David and Jonathan weren't willing to share each other. Do you see the difference? Sometimes in friendship, it's like, I need to protect this friendship. They're my friend. You get jealous when they do something else. But when you have a God-centered friendship, you say, you know what? I know we can't talk now. You've got a job to do. When Jonathan explains to the departure code to David, he says this, "But if I say to the youth, look, the arrows are beyond you, then go, for the Lord has sent you away. For the Lord has sent you away." Verse 22. Jonathan is able to say to his friend, "I will miss you, I will love you, but if the Lord is sending you away, then go." If the Lord has this season where you need to minister to other people, then go. If you need to build a bridge here to share the gospel, then go. If you need to move to another city, then you go. If you need to go overseas, I will miss you, but then you go. The Lord is sending you away. The Lord's glory, his fame, his honor is more important than the preservation of our friendship. You see, a transcendent purpose and having that is what will bring friends together, and it often provides the occasion for the friendship. I'm sure many of you are listening to the sermon and you think, if only I had a friend like this. How do you get these kinds of friends? Well, I remember when I was in college, I was part of a campus ministry, and there was a guy named Bob. Bob wasn't his real name. But Bob was a socially awkward individual who was kind of part of our group, and he would always tag along. Very nice guy. But he talked to me one day after the meeting and said, "Dave, can I talk to you?" Do you get a pit in your stomach when you hear that? I did. It's like, uh-oh, did I do something? I said, "Sure. When do you want to talk?" "Well, why don't you come to my room tomorrow?" So we agreed on a time, and I showed up at his room. I thought I was going to get rebuked. So we had some small talk, and then he said, "Dave, I have a question for you." "Go ahead." "I would like you to become my best friend." "Well, Bob, it's not you, it's me, right? I mean, I wasn't sure, what do you say, right?" I said, "Bob, it doesn't quite work that way. There is more of a natural rhythm to finding it where you're really pursuing the same thing with the same people, and eventually the Lord just kind of knits your heart to someone. You don't ask someone to be your best friend. You kind of acknowledge that they are." And so you look at this, and how do you forge these friendships? Well, you have that transcendent purpose where you want, more than anything, the glory of the Lord. You want the growth of the church. You want to see people come to Christ. And this might take place in a variety of ways. Often, trials will bring forth a transcendent purpose. That's why young men will go off to war and return, you know, as strangers and return as brothers. It's often the reason why young mothers begin to basically connect with one another. They're kind of in the trenches trying to survive during those early years. You have young men in seminary or in college and graduate school who kind of form this band of brothers or this circle of sisters. And then you have just tragedy and just coming together in the midst of the hurts and the pain of suffering where you're forced to rely on one another that forges these friendships. You see, your friends are often born from the common cause. And for you to have the friend you always wanted, you need to be the friend you always wanted. You need to develop these characteristics so that when that person is beside you as you are ministering, all of a sudden, note, your souls are being melded together. And frankly, your friends will determine your destiny. Did you know that? Who you choose to be your friends will determine whether or not your soul will be sustained or your soul will perish after a trial. Who you choose as your friend will hold you up or drag you down. Did you know that? Your friends determine your destiny. And frankly, some of you need to shift your friend priorities. When I was in high school, my best friends were all on the debate team. They tended to be cynical in nature. Many of them were atheist, very proud, very arrogant. I was among them. But my freshman year in college, I became a Christian and things began to change. I began to zealously share the gospel with them, perhaps too zealously, to the point where I was called by one of my old friends a Bible thumper from hell. I said, well, I might be a Bible thumper. I don't think I'm from hell. But there was a seismic shift in my friendships. Where these friends wanted, the old friends wanted the old Dave back. The one who'd use coarse jesting and just had all kinds of unsavory characteristics. But my new friends, the friends that I made in the Christian group, the band of brothers who had a desire to honor the Lord and reach the University of Kansas for Christ, the ones who would confront me on my sin, the ones who guarded my reputation, the ones who steered me away from making bad decisions. These were the men who loved me with the highest love because they loved me to the Lord. And time and distance has separated us, but that sacred bond is still there. Those friends were one of the means by which God rescued and sustained me and brought me to where I am. And by God's grace, I hope to be that friend to others as well. Your friends will determine your destiny. It was David and Jonathan's friendship that saved David's life. And to have the friend you always wanted, you need to be that friend that you always wanted. And through that friendship, the Lord will bless you and sustain you during times of adversity and beyond.